Hey, good morning, everyone. We're going to start in 1 minute. Okay, so good morning. I hope everyone's having a wonderful day and a wonderful week. I'm giving the share today in place of my father, Rabbi Gerari, who usually gives the Tuesday morning Parsha share. Next week, it'll be back to normal. He will be giving the share. This is sort of an extra share because it's not actually the Bina term at the moment. The Bina term with all of its programs begins next week. So let's get right into it. So this week's Parsha is Parsha's Matos Masei. It is actually the longest Torah reading that's possible in terms of the amount of verses, the amount of psukim that there are in this week's Parsha. That is because it's a double Parsha. It's Matos and Masei together. The longest Parsha in the Torah is Parsha's Nosoi. However, when Matos and Masei are together, they're combined, that actually creates the longest Parsha in the Torah in terms of how many psukim, how many verses there are in the Parsha. So if you're in shul this week, buckle up, it's going to be a long ride. Okay, so just to give you a little bit of an overview, first of all, on what the Parsha talks about, and then we'll get into some shorter insights, and then I want to share with you a bit of a longer idea based on the Parsha. So the overview of the Parsha, the things that the Parsha discuss are the annulment of vows, the laws of annulment of vows in great length. What happens if someone takes a vow, a man, a woman, all the different various laws about who can annul the vow, who can't annul the vow, how you annul the vow. Vows have great weight in the Torah. When someone says they're going to do something or they will not do something, that has great strength. A person has to keep it, unless there is a process called hataras nedarim, hafaras nedarim, of annulling vows in which you become free from that vow, and who has the power to do that. All of these laws are discussed at the very beginning of Parshas Matos. Then the Parsha continues about the war against Midian. So we've been learning in the past two Parshas about the story of the Midianite women who came and enticed the Jewish men, in order for the sole purpose of getting them to sin. And when they sin, then the Jewish people have less power. So they deserved punishment. And the whole length, the whole arichus, the whole story of the war against Midian, which is sort of like the revenge, so to speak, that the Jewish people took against the Midianites, is spoken about in great detail in this week's Parsha, how they came back and they didn't kill the women who had actually committed the sins. And Moshe Rabbeinu got upset, and then it talks about the spoils of war, what you have to do with the spoils of war, how they have to, so to speak, kasher them, put them in water, put them in fire, all of these things, and we'll get to a little bit later what they all mean. Then we have the episode of the tribes of Reuven and Gad, who their spoils from the war were a lot of cattle, a lot of sheep, and they needed a place which has good pasture, a lot of grass, for their cattle to eat. Therefore, they requested that their portion in the land of Israel should actually not be in the land of Israel. It should be what we call Eire HaYarden, on the other side of the Jordan. In other words, before you cross the Jordan into the land of Israel, they requested that land to be their portion. Moshe Rabbeinu gets upset at them. He says, "You like the spies, you're going to frighten everybody, that you don't want to go into the land of Israel, that you don't want to fight the war." And they say, no, we'll go and fight with the Jewish people, and then we'll come back. In the end, Moshe Rabbeinu agrees. Not only that, he actually gives the land to an additional half a tribe, Chatzi Shevet Menashe, half of the tribe of Menashe. So that's the end of Parshas Matos. Parshas Masei primarily talks about, the word Masei means the travelings, the journeys. Primarily talks about the various stops that the Jewish people took when they were in the desert, all the various places where they stopped. All 42 of them, actually, Mem Beis Masois, until they came to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel. So the parasha details that in great detail. And then there's also a mitzvah in Parashas Maaseh of the Ir Miklot. The Ir Miklot is when the Jewish people will conquer the land of Israel, they have to set aside certain cities to be a city of refuge for someone who murdered by accident or because of negligence, but it wasn't on purpose. They had to run away to the city of refuge, and then the immediate relatives were not allowed to kill them. They were safe there until the high priest died. That's just a general overview on the parsha. So I want to learn together with you now just some short insights, a couple of short insights onto the parsha. Hold on 1 second here. There we go. All right. Okay. So here you have a pasuk from this week's parsha, where Hashem is telling Moshe Rabbeinu to go and avenge and take revenge against the Midianites for causing the Jewish people to sin. So the pasuk says, "Nekoim nikmas bnei Yisrael, avenge the Israelite people, me'isam midyanim on the Midianites, achar te'osif al amecha, and after that you shall be gathered to your kin." In other words, Hashem is telling Moshe Rabbeinu, after this you will die, which is indeed what happens, because this week's parsha is Matas Maaseh, is the end of Chumash Bamidbar. The whole next Chumash is Chumash Devarim, which is Moshe Rabbeinu's last speech, and then Moshe Rabbeinu passes away. So this is actually sort of the last thing that Moshe Rabbeinu is doing, is sending the Jewish people to war. The question is, why is that relevant? What's the connection between the war with Midian and Moshe Rabbeinu dying? Okay, it's a historical fact that this was after this mitzvah of sending the Jewish people to fight against Midian, that's when Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. But every word in the Torah is exact, doesn't say anything extra. So why is it relevant that the Torah should tell us that? So the Beis Yaakov explains the following idea. He says, the Gemara tells us a story about a certain heretic who asked Rabbi Avuha the following question. Very interesting Gemara. The question was, your God is a kohen. Now, how do we know that? Because it says in a pasuk, elekechem, because we learn from various psukim that Hashem is considered a kohen, which means a priest. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean literally. It's another way of saying that Hashem is holy, right? But he says, if it says that Hashem is a kohen, we know that a kohen is not allowed to bury, anybody besides for their immediate relatives, because they're not allowed to become impure. A kohen has to be pure when, because they serve in the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, the question is, how was Hashem able to bury Moshe Rabbeinu? Because we know that Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. No one even knew exactly where Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. So the question is, who buried him? Hashem buried him. But if Hashem's a Kohen, how is he allowed to bury Moshe Rabbeinu? And this question that the heretic is asking is actually based on a true principle, in that there's a famous principle, the Medrash says, that whatever Hashem commands the Jewish people to do, he himself does it as well. We know this. The Gemara says, for example, what tefillin, what's written in Hashem's tefillin? In our tefillin, it's written the unity of Hashem. So what's written in Hashem's tefillin? So the answer is, the Gemara says over there that it's written about the specialty of the Jewish people. But whatever that means, it obviously doesn't mean literal physical tefillin, but the concept is there, that whatever Hashem commands us to do, he does it. So if Hashem commands the Kohanim not to defile himself to a dead body, and Hashem is a Kohen, so how is Hashem allowed to defile himself to Moshe Rabbeinu? So Rabbi Avuha answered him, he immersed in fire, and that Hashem immersed in fire. As it says in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, it says, God will come with fire. So the heretic asks, does immersion in fire help? So Rabbi Avuha said, it's a quote from the Gemara in English, immersion in fire is the primary method of purification. Immersion in water is the secondary one. Now, obviously, human beings, when they purify themselves, they cannot immerse in fire because that would end well, right? But Hashem, whatever that means, again, it's obviously, whenever the Gemara says such things, it obviously does not mean literally, but this is what he says, Hashem immersed in fire. So he's saying, on the contrary, actually, immersion in fire is actually the best thing. How do we know that? From this week's parasha. After the Jewish people came back from the war and they had spoils, Hashem told them that everything that was not used over the fire, you shall pass through the water. So in other words, anything that was used in fire, any vessels that the Jewish people had that were used in fire, that the Midianites had, that we used in fire, the Jewish people had to purify through putting through fire, which is where we learned the laws of kashering vessels. If they were not used in fire, then you can purify them in water. So we see that actually the primary method of purifying anything is through fire. So therefore, comes out like this. Moshe Rabbeinu dying and Hashem burying him was only, so to speak, possible after this mitzvah that Hashem gave of kashering vessels with fire. Because as Rabbi Avuah told this heretic, the only way Hashem was able to bury Moshe Rabbeinu was through immersion in fire. How do we know that immersion in fire helps? From the story of the war of Miriam, of the war of Midian. That's why the pasuk says, Nekoim nikvas bnei Yisrael mesa Midianim. Go and fight against the Midianim, and afterwards you'll be able to die. Because after this war you'll have spoils. I'll teach you the law that actually the best way of kashering something is through fire. That will then answer the question, how I am allowed to bury you after you pass away. Very original, nice pshat in this pasuk. Okay. Just an interesting second. Oh. Now, it says like this. In the next pasuk here, it says like this. Vayishlach oisam Moshe. Moshe dispatched them on a campaign. The army, elef lamata latsove oisam, 1,000 from each tribe. There's Pinchas ben Elazar HaKoyen, and Pinchas, the son of Elazar, also went in this war. So we learn out, actually, that over here, in this case, this war included in the tribes, there's 1,000 from each tribe. That actually includes the tribe of Levi, which is very unusual, because the Rambam says that the tribe of Levi never went to war. The tribe of Levi, their role was to serve God in the temple, serve Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash. They never went to war. So the question is, why in the war against Midian did the tribe of Levi yes go? And the answer is because it's a different type of war. Because the war for Eretz Yisrael, when the Jewish people conquered Eretz Yisrael, that was a material issue, a physical issue. In other words, they fought to conquer the enemy in order to take control of the land, and in order the Jewish people should be able to settle in a physical land. That tribe of Levi has no connection to. They're spiritual people. Their job is to serve God. However, the war against Midian was a spiritual war, because the war against Midian was not for the sake of conquest. It was for the sake of conquering the immorality of Midian, the immorality that the Midianite that the Midianites brought to the Jewish people. That was the war. Since it was a spiritual war, therefore the tribe of Levi were able to take part of it. Able to take part of it as well. Okay. Now we have a very interesting episode, and there's a very powerful lesson here from the Chidushei Harim, based on a few psukim here. When the Jewish people came back from the war against the Midianites, Moshe Rabbeinu was very upset. And it says like this, Vayiktsoif, here, source number 3, Vayiktsoif Moshe al Pkudei HaChoyel. Moshe became angry with the commanders of the army, Sorei Alafim, the officers of thousands, Sorei Ameis, and the officers of hundreds, Haboyim Mitzva Mulchama, who had come back from the military campaign. Why was Moshe Rabbeinu angry? Because they had left the women alive. Now, which women are we talking about? We're talking about the women who had created the whole problem to begin with. These Midianite women who came to the Jewish people and enticed them to sin, again, only for the sake of destroying the Jewish people. They were wicked people. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu says the whole point that you went to war was to fight against these people and you left them alive. So what happened? So they said, Vayoimru Moshe Avodecha, a little bit later on in the psukim. They said to Moshe, Avodecha, your servants, Nosu es roish anshi amuchama, have made a check of the warriors in our charge, asher biyodenu, which are in our hand, vele nifkad nimenu ish, and no one is missing. Vanakre v'skorben Hashem, ish asher motza klizo, v'tzodo v'tzomit habas, ogil v'chumos v'chapro, nafshi seinu lifnei Hashem. They said, so we have brought an offering to Hashem, such as articles of gold, each of us came upon, armlets, bracelets, signet rings, earrings, pendants, they all gave it to Hashem. What exactly is the conversation here? Moshe Rabbeinu was upset at them. They answered him, no one's missing. We're bringing sacrifices. So the Gemara, the Talmud in Tractate Shabbos, says the following. Vayiktsoif Moshe al Pkudei HaChoyel. It quotes the verse that we just learned before. That Moshe was angry with the officers of the army. Omer Rav Nachman, Omer Rabba Bar Avuah. Rav Nachman said in the name of Rabba Bar Avuah. He's explaining the pasuk. Omer lehem Moshe Yisrael. Moshe said to the Jewish people, Shema chazartem likulkulcha marishoin. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't necessarily worried that they left the women alive. That wasn't the issue. The issue was he's worried, why did they leave the women alive? Maybe when they were in the war, they actually committed the same sin that they went to war to take revenge against. Maybe they were enticed once again by those women. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, why did you leave the women alive? Maybe you came back. Maybe you went back to the original sin that you went to war against to begin with. That's what they answered him. Omru loy, they said to Moshe Rabbeinu, loy nifkab mimenu ish. No one's missing. They didn't mean physically. They didn't mean physically. They meant spiritually. No, not one man who went to war sinned. Not one man who went to war was enticed again. So Omar Lohem, so Moshe Rabbeinu says, and then if that's the case, Kapor in Kain, Kabor Loma, why the atonement? Because they said, no one's missing, and we're bringing sacrifices. Oh, so Moshe Rabbeinu is getting worried. Why are you bringing sacrifices? Usually sacrifices are brought as an atonement. So the question is, if you didn't do anything wrong, why are you bringing sacrifices? Omru Lohem, they said to him, Imidei Aveiro Yotsonu, Midei Hirur Lo Yotsonu. Yes, it's true, we didn't sin practically, but it could very well be that we had bad thoughts. And to atone for those bad thoughts, miyad vanakri v'skorban Hashem, they brought the korban, the sacrifice for Hashem. So in other words, they said the atonement is not for sinning in practice, it's the thoughts. The question is, what encouraged them to bring an offering for evil thoughts? Where did they get such an idea from? In other words, as long as they're not, seemingly, Judaism is a religion of action. Who cares what I think? The bottom line is what I actually do, right? The only thing that affects other people and seemingly has any meaning is what I actually do. Who cares what I think? So the Chiddush Yarim explains like this. We know that after Moshe Rabbeinu rebuked the Jewish people for permitting the women to live and in instructions to the commanders of the army, Elazar, who was Aaron's son, taught the people the mitzvah of kashering utensils. That what, as we mentioned before, all the utensils that were captured, that were spoils from the war, they were either made usable by passing through fire or immersion in boiling water, which is where we learn the laws, the halachas of kashering kelim today. So to the Jewish people, they didn't understand this mitzvah. It doesn't make any sense. Why is it not enough just to clean them? Right? Why seemingly do we have to kasher vessels if someone has a vessel which was used for non-kosher meat, for example? Why do I have to clean it with fire? Why do I have to kasher it with fire or water? Why can't I just clean it? Clean it from the non-kosher meat, and now it's kosher. Why do they have to go and boil water? Why do they have to go and put it through fire? So Elazar explained to them that actually the vessel is not only not kosher. When there's actually pieces of meat in the vessel is not kosher even if there's meat absorbed in the vessel. Right, which is what the laws of kashering are all about. The whole idea of kashering a vessel is not to get non-kosher meat out of the vessel because it's clean. The idea is that something, when you cook something in a pot or anything, it gets absorbed in the pot. And therefore, the only way to get it out there is to use the same type of heat that got it in there to begin with, which is why if it went through fire, put it through fire, went through water, you put it through water. So Elazar is teaching them that what makes a vessel not kosher is not only what you see in the vessel. It's not only what's actually there, it's what's in, absorbed within the walls, within the interior of the actual vessel, of the actual thing. Oh, so then the soldiers learned a new lesson. They looked at themselves. We are also a vessel. And sometimes we have non-kosher things inside of us, but there's two ways of that. One way is it is actually substance. We actually do things wrong. We actually have real non-kosher meat, so to speak, you know, figuratively speaking. You know, we actually do things that are incorrect, that are wrong. But sometimes we're clean. They looked at themselves, we're clean. We didn't commit any sin when we went to war. We didn't fall back into the trap of the Midianite women. The problem is, just like a vessel is not kosher when things are absorbed in the vessel, so they looked at themselves and they said, okay, we don't have actual substance of sin, but perhaps inside of us, in our minds, in our thoughts, in our consciousness, there's sin. And they realize that that's an issue. That also makes me not kosher. And therefore, they needed to kasher themselves, so to speak, and that's why they brought a sacrifice. That's what the Chiddush Yarim explains the where they learned this lesson from, that even thoughts are so important, which is a tremendous lesson in general. Because although, yes, it's true that Judaism is a religion of action, and therefore the most important thing is what we do. However, our thoughts are also very important. Many, many svarim, there are many Musar svarim and Sifrei Chassidus that speak about this. In the Gemara also, of course, speaks about Hirur Aveira, the concept of thinking about sin is also a problem. Because the truth is, what does this really all mean? It means that we need to serve Hashem, we need to serve God, not only with our hands, not only with our actions. We need to serve God with our entire being, and therefore our mind also needs to be clean. It's a very difficult thing. It's not easy to stop negative or evil thoughts, because thoughts are constant. It's much easier to control an action than it is to control a thought. However, it is possible, and it's something that we need to work on. Okay. Hold on a second. All right. The next part of the parasha, which I want to touch on briefly now, I'm going to come back a little bit more at length, is the passage about Umikne Rav Hoyo Libne Ruvain Libne God Otsu Ma'oid. It says the Reubenites, the tribe of Ruvain, the tribe of God, owned a lot of cattle. By Yiru es Eres Yazer ves Eretz Gilod, Vihine Amoki Moki Mikne, noting that the lands of Yazer and Gilod were reasonable, suitable for cattle. They asked Moshe Rabbeinu, please give us this place as our portion in the land of Israel. So the Baal HaTurim, I have it in front of me here, says like this. The Baal HaTurim is a short commentary on the Chumash. There's a lot of like gematrias in there and a lot of interesting things. So he notes on this like this. He says that the term B'nei God and B'nei Ruvain, which literally means the sons of God and the sons of Ruvain, are mentioned 8 times in this whole passage. And he says that's alluding to the fact that they went into exile 8 years before all the other tribes. Why? It's a punishment. And we'll see later exactly what they did wrong, and it's a whole long discussion. But it's a punishment from them not wanting to go into the actual land of Israel. They were exiled 8 years earlier than the other tribes. And that's alluded to in the fact that B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain is mentioned 8 times. And he explains that's also the pshat where it says in the pasuk that Shloima HaMelech describes their inheritance of B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain, describes it in the pasuk Nachla Mevoichelet Barishoima V'Acharisa Lo Sevorach, which means an inheritance seized hastily in the beginning, its end will not be blessed. This is in Proverbs. This is referring to the tribes of B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain, that they seized an inheritance quickly, but actually it didn't end up well because they got exiled 8 years earlier. And he says the word mevoichelet, which means seized, is written with a ches, but it's actually read as mevoichelet. Sorry, so it actually means hasty. So a lot of times in the Torah it can be written one way and read a different way. So it's written mevoichelet with a ches, but it's read mevoichelet, which means seized hastily. Why is it written with a ches? Because ches is 8. 8 is again alluding to those 8 years where they went into exile earlier. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu made an agreement with B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain that they would join their brothers in war, and only then would they go back. Not only did they comply with this condition, they actually remained there an additional 7 years till the land was divided up. So the question is, and not only that, Yeshua praised them. So why did they get punished? Why did they go into exile 8 years before everyone else? So the problem was like this. And this is a fascinating lesson in chinuch, in education. When the B'nai God and B'nai Ruvain told Moshe Rabbeinu, that they would arm themselves and go with their Jewish brethren into war, they said that they're going to leave their children and families behind. So only they went, and then they came back afterwards to join their families after the battle was finished. Now, when the Jewish people crossed the Yarden, crossed the Jordan River, there was tremendous miracles. Hashem split the sea, the ark, the Aron carried the Kohanim across, tremendous, tremendous miracles. The entire conquest of Eretz Yisrael was filled with miracles. The walls of Jericho fell down. The whole way they conquered, no one died besides for one war, but no one, generally speaking, not one Jewish soldier died. Miraculous, seriously miraculous. So they witnessed the miracles of Hashem with their own eyes. Personally seeing Hashem's miracles leaves a much more everlasting impression than hearing about them, right? Seeing is believing. When you see something, it affects you much more deeply. When you just hear about it, you hear about it. It doesn't inspire you as much. Therefore, even though the adults, the men, went to fight the war and they witnessed all these miracles, but their children were left behind. And their children were never educated properly as well as they were, because their children never saw with their own eyes the miracles of Hashem. And therefore, they were not witness to Hashem's greatness, and that's why they went on a moral decline faster than the other tribes, which is why they were exiled 8 years earlier. Which is fascinating, because the word for education is chinuch, and the first letter of the word chinuch is ches, which is also the numerical value of 8, which is why they were, so in other words, the reason why they were exiled 8 years earlier is because they lacked in chinuch, in education of their children, which is a tremendous lesson, because, you know, we all have experiences, and many of us have children that we're trying to inspire. We have to make sure to try and give them the same experiences. Now, not always is that possible, right? In this case, the miracles only happen then. But we have to try our best to expose them to the same. In other words, it means more in a general sense that, you know, if we were exposed to the beauty of Yiddishkeit, the beauty of Torah, the beauty of mitzvahs, we have to make sure to expose our children to the same thing. We shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't only hear about it, they should also see it. You know, there should be something which is ingrained in them to their very core that it actually remains with them. Okay, moving on to the next parsha, and we'll come back to the story of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuben in a moment. But I just want to go and share with you a few short ideas in the next parsha of Parshas Maaseh. So it says like this: Eile Maaseh Bnei Yisrael. These are the journeys, the journeys of the Jewish people. Asher Yotzu Me'eretz Mitzrayim Tzivoysom Yad Moshe V'Aaron, who started out from the land of Egypt, troop by troop, in the charge of Moshe and Aaron. And then goes a list. 42 journeys of the Jewish people. The question is, why does it say the word Eile? These are. It could have just said, again, every word in the Torah is exact. It could have just said, Maasei Bnei Yisrael, the journeys of the Jewish people were this. What do you mean, these are? The word these, Eile, is a little bit superfluous. So one of the Mefarshim said like this, that the Jewish people suffered 4 exiles in addition to the Egyptian. Sometimes we say that we only have 4 exiles, sometimes it says we have 5. So we have the Egyptian exile. In addition to that, there are 4. Aleph, Mem, Beis, Yud. Okay, so Aleph, Mem, Beis, Yud is the Aleph is Edoim, Modai, Bavel, and Yavon, which are Rome, Mede and Persia, Babylon, and Greece, Syria. So Edoim, Modai, Bavel, Yavon, which is Aleph, Mem, Beis, Yud. The first letter of the first 4 words in this week's parsha, Eile, Maaseh, Bnei Yisrael, hint to the 4 exiles which will come after the redemption of Egypt. The Pasuk is saying that these are the journeys that the Jewish people had when they left Egypt. So here it says, Eile is Aleph, that's Edoim, Maaseh is Modai, Bnei is Bavel, and Yud for Yisrael is Yavon, hinting to the fact that, yes, it's true, we went out of Egypt, but we will have an additional 4 exiles till we get to the coming of Mashiach. So that's a very bad news, right? But the truth is, the first 2 words allude to the redemption as well. Because these 2 words, Aleph and Mem, allude to all the redeemers to these 4 exiles. How so? Aleph and Mem is Mem is Moshe, Aleph is Aharon. Those took us out of Egypt. We have the exile of Persia and Babylon were redeemed through Mordechai and Esther. That's also Aleph and Mem. And when Mashiach will come, will redeem us from the exile of Edom, of Rome, which is our exile we're in now, it will be who? Moshiach is Mem, and who will announce Mashiach's coming? Eliyo Hanavi, which is an Aleph. So the Aleph and the Mem not only alludes to the future exiles, but also alludes to the future redemption as well. We have in this week's parsha as well the account of Aaron's death, where it says, Vayal Aaron Hakoyen El Hoir Hahor Al Pi Hashem. Aaron the priest ascended Mount Hoir Hahor and died there. Vayomosham Mishnasar Boy would say it's Mishrom Eretz Yisrael in the 40th year of the Jewish people leaving Egypt. Bachoidesh Achamishi Beechot Lachoidesh, on the first day of the fifth month. Now, it's interesting that the passing of Aaron is first recorded in Parshas Chukas. But over there, it doesn't mention the date. Here it mentions the date, which, by the way, is Rosh Chodesh Av, the first of the month of Av. And the reason is because it's the middle of, we know that right now we're in the period of the 3 weeks, the Bein HaMetzorim, and Rosh Chodesh Av is then. His passing was a very sad event in that the entire Jewish people mourned even more than they mourned for Moshe Rabbeinu, because we know that Aaron HaKohen made peace between everybody and everyone loved him. And Parshas Maaseh, this week's parsha, is always read during the 3 weeks, either on or very close to Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av. And therefore, it's very appropriate that the date of his passing is noted in this week's parsha. There's also a lesson to that, in that Aaron was renowned for his Avas Yisrael, his love of his fellow Jew. He always promoted peace. He always made peace between people. And one of the causes, the primary causes, for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash was the concept of Sinas Chinam, of baseless hatred. And therefore, we read about Aaron's passing during this time of the 3 weeks, teach us that lesson that we have to be like Aaron, we have to be Oyev Shalom, Roidev Shalom, we have to love peace and pursue peace. Just share with you one more vart at the end, and then I'll get into something a little bit more in depth. The end of the parsha, we have the mitzvah of Orei Miklat. And there were six cities of refuge, but besides that, there were 42 cities. The 42 cities were the 42 cities of the Levim, and they were also Orei Miklat. They were also cities of refuge. So the Oyev Yisrael, the Apterov, says the following idea. This is an idea which was brought in many many Sifrei Chassidus, that the idea of murder, spiritually speaking, is the idea of committing any sin. So when someone commits a sin, he's killing, so to speak, part of his neshama, part of his soul. So to speak, taking life force from his neshama. A person's soul thrives on Torah and mitzvahs, lives off. We say, ki heim chayenu, Torah and mitzvahs is the life of the soul. When a person breaks Torah and mitzvahs, they're, so to speak, murdering their soul to a certain degree. However, no Jew really wants to commit a sin. We know that deep down, every single Jew really wants to do the right thing. It's just sometimes there's an external force which, so to speak, covers over that inner desire and allows us to desire sin. Therefore, every sin that we do, in essence, is really by mistake. In other words, it's not really what we wanted to do, intrinsically. Still responsible for obviously, but in intrinsically, essentially, it's a mistake. It's not really who we want to be. So therefore, every time we transgress the word of Hashem, we're murdering our soul, but by accident. It's not really what we want to do. And therefore, we need an Ir Miklat. Says the Apterov, where's the Ir Miklat? So Shema Yisrael Hashem Eleikeinu Hashem Echad is six words. Those are the six corresponding to the six special Ari Miklat. And V'yahafta till Uvisharecha, the first paragraph of Shema, has 42 words. And therefore, if you want to know what the Ir Miklat, the city of refuge, if you want to save your soul, you want to save your neshama, you want to go to a city of refuge where it could be safe, so to speak, and restored, where does that happen? In the Shema Yisrael and the Yahafta. In Kabbalah's O Malchus Shemaim, of re-accepting upon ourselves the yoke of heaven, re-accepting upon ourselves the love of Hashem, the Yahafta Hashem Elikecha. The person immerses himself in that, that will be a city of refuge where they can restore and save their neshama once again. Okay. I want to get into a little bit deeper now the story of B'nai Gad and B'nai Ruven, and to understand what they wanted, what Moshe Rabbeinu wanted from them, and how what we're supposed to learn from it. There's some good and there's some mistake that they made as well that we have to learn from as well. Just to preface, there are two conflicting midrashim, two conflicting insights into this story, which one seems to make them look like very good people, and the other one seems to make them look like very bad people. One midrash says, like this, one midrash Rabbah, Keheles Rabbah says, that Shevet Reuven and Gad, the tribe of Reuven and Gad, since they distanced themselves from gezel, from theft, therefore Hashem said, I'm going to give you a place where there's no theft, meaning where there's a lot of pasture, where there's a lot of place for your cattle to eat grass, and they don't have to go to other people's places and steal from them. So as a reward for being careful to not steal anything, Hashem rewarded them by giving them a place where there is no need to steal. There's a lot of pasture, there's a lot of green, and their cattle will have what to eat. That's one medrash. Seems to imply this was actually a very good thing. Another medrash says that actually on the contrary, they weren't good. It says, the expression is, she'osu esa iker tofel vesa tofel iker. They made what is supposed to be the main thing secondary, and they made the secondary thing, they made it the primary thing. In other words, they focused, why? Because they loved their money, their cattle, more than their souls. In other words, for them, for the people, it would be more beneficial to go into the land of Israel. But they loved their money, their cattle, more than they loved their people. So what's supposed to be your main focus, which is people, that became the secondary. What's supposed to be your secondary focus, your money, your possessions, that became them their main focus. So that medrash seems to imply that they were doing something wrong. Right? That they weren't doing the right thing. Excuse me for a moment. All right. So which one is it? Were they doing the wrong thing? Were they doing the right thing? So it's explained the following idea. In Kabbalah, explains the following concept. There's a general idea which is explained in many places, and we can apply it to here as well. The difference between the Ovos and the Shvatim. Our forefathers, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and the Shvatim. The Shvatim, the tribes, the sons of Yaakov, they were all shepherds. That was their occupation. That's what they did. They didn't do anything else. The Ovos were involved in other things as well. What's the difference? Being a shepherd means that you're able to be separate from the world. Being a shepherd means that you went to the mountains, you had sheep, you sat there all alone. There were no other people there, only animals. No one to be affected by, no one to influence you. In other words, it's a very safe environment spiritually. You're able to serve Hashem in peace without any disturbance. Those who get involved in other pursuits, other jobs, involved in the world, that's much more dangerous, right? There you can be influenced negatively, spiritually, by the world, by people. It's a much more dangerous environment. And therefore the tribes, they chose to put themselves in a much more safer environment, so they shouldn't be influenced by the world. Within the tribes themselves, here you find the difference of the Bnei Gad, Bnei Reuven, and the rest of them. Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven wanted to be shepherds. They didn't want to go into the land of Israel. The reason is because in the land of Israel, you would have to tend to the land, you have to get involved in business. They were worried that that will damage them spiritually. And therefore, they said, let's stay out of Israel. Let's stay shepherds in the mountains where there's green, there's no people around. We can stay safe spiritually. We'll be in a safe environment. The other Jewish people said, no, we have to go into the land of Israel. We have to develop the land. We have to deal with the physical land. Which one of these approaches shows that you're more connected to God? All right, it's an interesting question. Which person is stronger in their connection to Hashem? someone who needs to remain separate from the world in order to remain connected to Hashem, or someone who can get involved in the world and still stay connected to Hashem? The answer is the one who has a deeper and stronger connection to God is the one who can go into the world, interact with society, interact with people who think differently than you and may have a negative influence on you and not be influenced and still stay strong in your beliefs. Such a person is more connected to Hashem, not less. Another way of saying this is this: to the people who have to remain separate from the world, that means that to them, the world is a force to be reckoned with. In other words, negativity, the negative spiritual atmosphere to them is real. And therefore, it's very difficult to overcome it. And therefore, they need to remain separate. They need to run away from it. But those who are so secure in their connection to Hashem, that the only thing that matters to them is God and Torah and mitzvahs, and nothing else exists in their reality to such a degree that they can even go into the world, they can even interact with the world, and the world still won't make a difference to them. Because they're the world, in other words, the world and worldliness and physicality and all the negativity that is associated with that is so nothing to them. It's so meaningless to them that they can even interact with it and it won't influence me anyway. That's the difference between Bnei God and Bnei Ruvain, which is why Moshe Rabbeinu was upset at them. He said, why is the world so important to you that you need to remain separate from it? That you need to, if you need to negate something, it means that it's there, right? You can't negate nothing. If you need to remain separate from the world, that means that to them, the world and worldliness was a force to be reckoned with. The other tribes were not worried about that because to them, they were so connected and the world was so nothing, they were able to go into it and still not be influenced. That's the pshat, the deeper pshat in the Medrash, where the Medrash says that Bnei God and Bnei Ruvain didn't steal, and that's why they got this land. One way of learning this is it's actually a negative thing. How so? Stealing is obviously a bad thing. However, everything that exists in the negative always exists in the positive as well. Hashem created the world, it says, Zeh le'uma zeh. It's like a mirror image. There's negativity, there's positivity, there's holiness, there's impurity, and they mirror each other for whatever reason. Now, I don't have time to get into that, but that's the way it is. So if there's stealing in the negative sense, there's also stealing in the positive sense. What's stealing in the positive sense? How can you steal? What stealing can be positive? So it says in a Medrash as follows. It says, Yaakov says to Esav, there are two, Yaakov and Esav, two brothers. Yaakov said to Esav, there are two worlds. There's this world and there's the world to come. There's the physical world and there's the spiritual world. You take the physical world, I'll take the spiritual world. You know, Esav, you can have Olam Hazeh, you can have this physical world, I'll take Olam Haba, I'll take the future world, I'll take the spiritual world. What happened? When Yaakov comes home from Lavan's house and he has cattle and he has wives and children, he has a whole, you know, he's built up this tremendous life. Esav says to him, I don't understand. You said that you're only going to take Olam Haba and I'm going to take Olam Hazeh. Where do you have all this money from? In other words, you took from my world. Esav says, Olam Hazeh, the physical world belongs to me. The spiritual world belongs to you. So why did you take from the physical world? What's in other words going on here? Esav represents immorality, lack of godliness, physicality. What Esav is saying is like this. There's the spiritual world. You want to serve God? No problem. Go to shul. Daven, learn, put yourself in an atmosphere of spirituality. But this physical world, Esav says, belongs to me. There's no God here. Here you have to be like everyone else. Here you have to go into the world and use the world just like everyone else uses the world. Says Yaakov, no. The whole purpose of creation is to go into the world of Esav, to go into the physical world and steal from Esav. In other words, take what Esav claims to be his, take what impurity, immorality, lack of godliness claims to be theirs, and make a godliness. Bring Hashem there as well. Stealing in a good way means to go into the world which by default is not, so to speak, God's place, and make it God's home. Steal it for God. Steal it away. I don't mean physically here. I mean figuratively speaking. Take the world which is normally associated with lack of godliness and steal it from that domain and make it a godly place. Says the Medrash, what was Bnei God and Bnei Reuven's issue? They didn't steal. In other words, they were not ready to go into the world and make it a home for Hashem. They wanted to remain separate from the world. They wanted to remain away from Esau's world. They just wanted to be, let's just stick to Yaakov's world. Why go into Esau's world at all? It's a dangerous place. Said Hashem, that you did the wrong thing. Because you didn't steal, because you're not ready to steal, so to speak, because you're not ready to go into the physical world and make it godly. Therefore, you're going to remain here outside of Eretz Yisrael, because you're not ready to go into Israel. You're not ready to go into the world and change it. And that was their mistake. That was their problem. The truth is, this is also connected to the beginning of Parshas Matos. The beginning of Parshas Matos discusses the laws of nedarim, of vows. A vow, what's a vow? A vow means, truth is, taking a vow is not necessarily a good thing. It says that the nedarim is a siyog laprishus. Nedarim, taking vows, means that you're abstinent. You separate yourself from the world. Meaning, there are certain things which Hashem says is forbidden, so that we stay away from. But things that Hashem says are permitted, we're supposed to use. What does it mean, use? Not for our own benefit. We're supposed to use to make a dwelling place for Hashem in them. We're supposed to eat food, make a bracha, eat it in a refined way, bring godliness into the food. You're not supposed to make a vow, I'm not going to eat this, because if you do that, then you're remaining separate from it. Okay. How do you annul a vow? You annul a vow, one of the ways it says is that a chacham, a wise man, in other words, a Torah scholar, oiker es haneder, can uproot the vow. Why does it use such an expression, a chacham? So I'm going to explain to you a little bit of a Kabbalistic concept here. Okay? It says like this, we know that there's different facets of a person's intellect. There's what's known as chachma, Bina and Das. Okay, we're not going to get involved in Das now. I want to discuss Chochma and Bina. In Kabbalah, it says that a neder, a vow, lives in the world of Bina. And in order to uproot the vow, you need the Chocham, meaning you need the Chochma to uproot the vow which was made in the world of Bina. What does that mean? So what does Chochma and Bina actually mean? Before we get into what it means spiritually, what does it actually mean on a practical level? When a person wants to understand something, there are two stages. One is when you get this like flash, where the idea which you're trying to get to suddenly appears in your mind. It's like almost like revealed to you. You think about something, suddenly like, oh, I got it, right? It's like a flash of lightning. That's the way it's described. But you don't fully understand it yet. You couldn't explain it to someone else what you got. You just know that you got it. That's Chochmah. Bina is about me taking that concept and developing it, internalizing it, properly understanding it, going into details, figuring out if it contradicts other ideas, widening it, going deeper, making it wider, going into it in more details, et cetera, right? Which is why, by the way, in Kabbalah, Chochmah and Bina is the masculine energy and the feminine energy. It says that a woman, in the Gemara, it says that a woman has Bina Yisera, extra wisdom, which means literally, of course, but there was a deeper idea there as well, is that in the process of creating a child, the male gives one little thing, and what does the female do? The female takes it and creates a child with all of its details, all of its limbs, right? So what that means is, is that in the process of creating a child, which is emotions, spiritually speaking, emotions are born out of intellect. When you understand the greatness of something, you love it. So the process, the chachma, is the nekuda, is the point of it, is the essence of the idea. Bina is taking that idea and developing it and making it, building it, making it a full child, so to speak, a full thing with all of its details. In other words, like this, chachma is when the idea is revealed to me. In other words, it's not so much about me. In fact, chachma is about getting rid of your ego. It's about letting the idea shine. Let the idea being revealed to me. If you think too much, you're not going to have the chachma. You have to almost take a step back and just look at the picture. Bina is when I introduce my input here, is where I become active. I need to think about it. I need to understand it. I need to develop it. So in Chassidus, it explained that chachma is the concept of bittul, of being subservient to something higher, like it is an intellectual idea, where I'm just focusing on the idea, not on how I understand it, rather just the thing. And bina is where ego begins. Bina is where I introduce me, where I try and understand it. Which means like this, coming back to Nedarim. When I make a neder, when I make a vow, why do I need to make a vow? A vow means I want to separate myself from the world. Going back to the idea, why does a person need to separate themselves from the world? Because they give the world importance. Therefore, the world's a threat. If the world's a threat, you need to separate yourself from it. In other words, in Kabbalah it says, Nedarim, vows, live in the world of Bina. In the world where ego begins. Where ego begins, now there's a me, there's an I, there's a world. In other words, there's something outside of godliness. If there's something outside of godliness, which is a threat to godliness, I can't be too involved in it because it's dangerous to me. That's why I need to make a net there. I need to separate myself from it. How? What's the antidote to that? Says the Torah, a chacham is oikar es haneder. You need to access the level of chacham. If you go to the level of chacham, which is absolute subservience, where nothing besides for the idea exists in our context, in our discussion, nothing besides for God exists and everything else is just a part of that reality, then I don't need to make a neder anymore. Because now I can go into the world, I can interact with the world and still not be affected because there's nothing else besides for God. The world's not a threat anymore. And that's the same message that Moshe Rabbeinu was telling the Bnei God and Bnei Reuven. It's very fine, you want to remain shepherds outside of the land, you want to remain separate, but that means that you're not fully subservient to God. That means that the world has too much importance to you. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu compares them to the Meraglim. He compares them to the spies. Because the spies made the same exact mistake. We know the famous idea explains in Likutei Torah, the spies came back from Eretz Yisrael and they gave a bad report. Why? Because they wanted to remain in the desert. They wanted to remain in the spiritual world, in the spiritual space that they were in the desert. They didn't want to go into Eretz Yisrael. They didn't want to go into the land of Israel. Why? Because they didn't want to be engaged in the physical world because they felt it was too dangerous. Says Moshe Rabbeinu to these two tribes, you're like the spies, you're making the same mistake. But they didn't make the same mistake. How do we know that? Because they didn't die, right? The spies, Hashem killed them. The tribes, Hashem didn't punish them. Why not? Because Moshe Rabbeinu told them like this. This is really a very important concept. I will end with this. The mistake of the spies wasn't so much that you have some people who remain
separate from the world.
Because the truth is you need that as well. Because going back to the discussion, yes, it's true that the purpose of creation is to interact with the world and to engage with the world and to be involved in the world. And in order to do that, you need to be connected to God in even a deeper way, etc. That's all true. However, there needs to be a group of people who don't get involved in the world. That's both in people and in time. In other words, everyone needs to have a time when they're not involved in the world, which for everyone is really Shabbos, right? Most of the time is weekday. We're involved in the world, but Shabbos, when we take a step back. And the same thing is within the Jewish people themselves. There needs to be the Talmidei Chachamim. It needs to be the Gedolei Yisrael. It needs to be the people who sit in Kollel the whole day and learn. We need those people. Because why? Because if everyone is involved in the world, what can happen is, the danger of that is that ultimately our connection to Hashem will be weakened and the world will influence us. The only way that won't happen is if you have those people who remain separate and inspire us, those the regular people, the mainstream people who are involved in the world. We need people who are remain separate, who continue to inspire us from above, so we can remain connected. The mistake of the spies were they wanted everyone to remain in the desert. And that's a mistake. Because the purpose of creation is that the majority of the Jewish people need to be involved in the world, in creation. B'nei Gad and B'nei Ruvain, they're like the Rosh Hashiva. They're like the people who remain separate. Moshe Rabbeinu says that's okay. However, you need to stay connected to the people in Israel. You need to go with them and fight with them. In other words, you cannot just remain in your own four walls and remain spiritual. There's no point in that. There is only a point if you connect with the people who are involved in the world. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu tells them, you know what, you can keep this and you won't even be punished. It's fine. We need people who remain spiritual, but you need to remain connected to those who do go into Israel. Don't be like the spies who thought that everyone should be removed from the world. Be the people removed from the world, but who continue to inspire most the majority of the people who do go into Eretz Yisrael and who are changing the world and making it a more of a godly place. So in other words, what the lesson is like this. Lesson is the purpose of creation is to go into the world, interact with the physical world, have a job, go into business, and bring God there. Remain connected to Hashem in such a deep way that the world's not a threat to you, that the physical immorality of the world won't affect you because you're connected in such a deep, intrinsic way. But we also need to know is that B'nai God and B'nai Ruve need to be. We need some people who don't go into the world. We need some people who remain untainted, totally removed and inspired. And we ourselves need to go there as well sometimes. We also need to take a step back. We need to have a Shabbos. We need to have a davening every morning. We need to have a time and a space where we go spiritual. But we need to remember that these two things cannot remain disconnected. There's only a purpose in remaining spiritual if the spiritual affects the physical. And being in the physical only works if you remain connected to the spiritual. And that's why the Bnei God and Bnei Ruvain need to interact with the other tribes. Wishing everybody a wonderful day and a wonderful week.